April 4th, and welcome everybody. First up on our agenda are the long-suffering cities who are finally get to present. I'm going to open an informational hearing.
Chair Blair, members of the committee, Andy Shaw with the League of Cities. We really appreciate the opportunity to come present a report that we've just released to you on the growing need for investing in our city streets, which we're viewing as an asset that we hold that unfortunately is falling into a state of neglect. The report, I hope, gives you an overview of city road needs, and it also contains 19 case studies of specific cities, giving you a glimpse into the variety of local circumstances that cities find themselves in. Last week, the Oregon Business Council gave you pretty compelling evidence with their report about the economic importance of state and local roads to our economy, to our society. Transportation infrastructure is vital to bringing employment growth to our communities and keeping jobs here. With no increase in the state gas tax since 1993, revenues are not keeping pace and we're not maintaining purchasing power. Cities have taken great strides to try to fill that gap on the local level, but we simply cannot do that within local resources, and so additional statewide resources are required. Pavement management is never a sizzling issue as others are, but it's a vital issue to our economy. It helps us maintain desirable communities, places people want to live. It helps us attract and maintain the businesses we have. There's numerous examples of companies that have recently come to Oregon that wouldn't have had the transportation infrastructure been in worse shape, and we're concerned about going down the route of worsening roads and being less attractive. Certainly, there are significant safety issues when roads fall into disrepair. And probably most importantly, from a financing point of view, the long-term costs of failing to maintain our roads properly are enormous. 6 to 10 times the cost of maintenance if we have to reconstruct roads rather than maintaining them. This graph is a graphic example of what I'm speaking to. The red line represents the life cycle of a road over about 20 years. And as you come down the curve, the cost of repairing the road increases dramatically. The blue lines indicate examples of scheduled maintenance being conducted at a relatively low cost, and then maintaining the life of that road over time, such that out at 25 years, you've got a brand new road, and you spend a lot less money than you would have had you let the road fall into disrepair and required that it be reconstructed. Many cities have adopted pavement management systems that are robust systems, computer systems that they use to monitor and maintain their roads to schedule regular maintenance. The good thing about that is you can gauge when you need to spend money and you can gauge when you need to repair roads. The bad thing for the city of Gresham in particular, in this example, is they can watch their roads steadily decline and fall down this pavement condition index chart. And so they're very, very aware now that their roads are falling from what was a good condition in the mid-1990s to what is what will be a poor condition in the year 2011, as this graph shows. The variety of local funding sources is determined by economics, by geography, levels of local support. Some cities still are able to maintain local general fund subsidies for their street fund. Fewer and fewer cities are able to do that with the pressures that Measure 5 and 50 create for cities. A growing number of cities are spending more than 100% of their property tax revenues on public safety, squeezing out any support they could give to the street fund. Many cities have adopted transportation SDCs so that to mitigate the impacts of development on their transportation system and also to help fund new roads. Local gas taxes can raise revenues from both residents and non-residents who use the roads locally, but they can also be very hard to enact and get voters to support. But they provide a critical source of funding for a number of communities. Franchise fees, charged of utilities, help pay for many roads and rights of way. Transportation utility fees are a growing and popular source of finding additional funds. They're based on estimates of use of the roads, but they draw funds from a broader base than just user fees, which we think is an important direction for us to be heading in the conversation we have with the public about roads, that we should all be funding roads separate from use because of their importance to delivering goods, to getting children to school, and so on and so forth. Local improvement districts, yes.
Yes, Representative.
On that chart, and maybe I'm missing it, or it'll come up later. Where is local government's share of the state gas tax money in that funding stream?
These are all local sources. So these are all examples of how cities supplement.
Okay, so it's important to, if I may.
Yes.
And I'm a huge fan of where you're going with this, but what I think it's important to point out, though, that there are other funding streams available to local government for their road maintenance needs.
Yes. Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, about half of most cities' budgets for street maintenance comes from the state gas tax.
Perfect. Thank you.
And this. A slide represents the variety of local sources that cities tap into when they're able to do that. So local improvement districts are another source of funding. LIDs are only used for specific projects. They're time limited. They're space limited. Lastly, county revenue sharing. A number of counties receive, in some instances, 50 to 80% of their local road budget from counties, largely sourced from federal timber revenues. So those cities will be losing, most of those cities have already lost those funding sources as counties are preparing for the loss of federal funds. This is just a quick example of a few cities and some stats about them. Ashland, for example, has a very robust mix of local revenue sources, but its funding represents only 64% of local, the local funding is only 64% of the total funding for the city. Gresham has an advanced and aggressive pavement management system. Its local funding is 44% of its total funding. John Day is almost totally reliant for local funding on the county. That's 64% of its budget. North Plains has enacted a local transportation utility fee. That and county revenue sharing represents 50% of all of their revenues. All of these cities, taking very different approaches, face significant shortfalls in the amount of revenues they need to maintain their roads properly. This summer, we conducted a survey of cities attempting to get figures on how much cities expend on road maintenance, what lane miles they are responsible for maintaining, and identify the gap between their existing expenditures and how much they should spend to properly maintain the roads in their estimates. We looked at models of expenditures per lane mile developed by the federal government, developed by private entities, and came up with the best estimate we can of the statewide gap in funding resources. It's using a $14,000 per mile per lane mile annual maintenance cost, which is that last bar on the chart. You can see a variety of cities where they stack up compared to that expenditure per lane mile. When we figured that expenditure per lane mile and then went to survey the cities, we got to very similar figures for what they estimated their funding gap was and this lane mile expenditure estimate would give them. When you look at the total state, we're looking at a $160 million funding gap for maintenance and preservation alone when you multiply the number of lane miles times this $14,000 figure and then subtract out what cities spend now from all sources. We estimated what gas tax would be required to raise that $160 million, and it's a very high figure, so we're not really talking about it. But we would love to see the state begin to help us meet that gap. The challenges that cities face, the state gas tax rate has been stagnant. On a per capita basis, revenues to cities are falling. Increased fuel efficiencies, which have other benefits, affect the revenues that cities get. We get less dollars per gallon from today's cars than we did from cars in the early 1990s, even though the road wear most of those cars create is the same. Road construction costs are soaring, even as our revenues are shrinking on a per capita basis. And cities face growth of in the range of a million people in the next 20 to 15 years that mostly will be need to be accommodated by cities and not unincorporated areas. This is just a graphic representation of the lack of gas tax increase. This is a more telling chart, though, that shows the drop in per capita revenues to the two cities from the highway fund, comparing that against the rise in construction costs. In 2006 alone, construction materials rose by 10%. Since 1993, construction material costs have risen 70%, while while highway fund revenues have only risen by 52%. This shows the actual population growth that cities have experienced. You can see the proportion of the population living in unincorporated.
Our little charts don't have this information on them.
I apologize for that.
That's okay.
I can get you those.
We can look.
Yes. The copier must have eaten them. This chart shows the population growth, actual growth in cities versus unincorporated areas. If that trend continues, you can see the astonishing number of people that cities will need to be accommodating over the next 10 to 15 years. And lastly, leave you with this. This is a comparison of the per gallon charges of highway users. Oregon is the lowest of all the western states. We urge you to take steps now to address the significant gap. We think there is room, as this chart shows, to raise the fees and the taxes that we use to generate maintenance and preservation resources. And we urge you to begin acting now on this urgent issue for cities.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the other states that are listed up there, are there gas taxes, vehicle sales tax, and other fee taxes? Are all those dedicated strictly to roads, just like our gas taxes?
I don't actually have the answer to that question. I know in other states they do. California, for example, raises bonds they pay for out of the state general fund. So to the extent that sales taxes, for example, aren't dedicated strictly to roads, they do supplement road construction out of the general fund.
Yes, Madam Chair, I just think it's important to make sure we're comparing apples to apples. And in Oregon, our gas tax is dedicated to roads. It can only be used for roads. And I'm curious if the other states have that same condition. Anyway,
on the vehicle sales tax, I don't have an answer to that question. I think the point we're trying to make is the costs that a consumer faces in other states for purchasing and using a car are much, much lower than in Oregon.
You mean higher?
Higher.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, may I ask these questions? Actually, let me first start off with a statement. Where I come from, I think the standards of our roads, that we think are acceptable, are very, very
different than what perhaps Multnomah County, their standards are. And I wonder, as you were undertaking the survey and you were asking the conditions of the roads, if everyone was using the same standards to make comparison.
I think the answer is yes, Chair by Representative Smith, because we're looking at road conditions that are pretty well accepted in the engineering public works community. We're looking at a standard of keeping roads in a good condition, which is up on that road life cycle curve up above 70, so that you can avoid a very high cost of road reconstruction. I think one of the problems we face is public recognition of poor road conditions is limited, because until a pothole occurs, it's not obvious that to the general public that there's a problem with the road. Cracks and these alligator cracks that move on down the road are assigned to an engineer that there's a serious problem. They may not be clear to the public.
Okay. Just one last
one.
I agree with you. This is a significant issue. I've actually... last session as Ways and Means co-chair of the Transportation Committee. In the back of my mind, I kept thinking about this issue. And I guess I would hope that the League of Oregon Cities could come to us with a solution. I think we know the problem. It would be nice to hear what the alternatives are and then let the legislative body as a whole try and determine if that's, you know, the solution you provide is an option they're willing to consider. I don't think anyone's going to deny that our city roads are deteriorating. So perhaps in the future we could, it'd be great to have a discussion on the solution to the problem. Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, just to report back to committee, this morning I met with a couple of folks from the Association of Oregon Counties, and we tried to figure out some of the kinds of tools that could be used by the counties, including special assessment districts, those kinds of things, things that we've talked about here in committee. And I just wanted to echo what Representative Smith has just asked Andy, and that is, you know, have they considered the possibility of any of those kinds of tools that other communities have faced, and maybe not just Oregon communities? This road deterioration situation is not unique to Oregon cities. I cannot believe that the costs that escalated by 10% of materials in 2006 for all cities in Oregon didn't accelerate by at least that amount in other cities nationwide. And so what did they do to crawl out of the problems, and what are the options that the cities are looking at in coming to the legislature to say, wait a minute, take off this one exemption here, make this change, you know, tweak this law in this way, turn the valve a little bit up over here. Do you have any of those kinds of suggestions, Andy?
If I may, Chair, by Representative Butler and Representative Smith, I think our strong call today is for action on a state gas tax increase. That's one of the most significant sources of revenues to cities to fund road maintenance. Cities are seeking many ways on their own to use local financing tools to address the problem. But as this report points out, in the city of Lowell, for example, you'd have to charge $15 per month per dwelling just to make up for that city's loss of county revenues to keep their existing street budget whole. It doesn't begin to address their need for revenues to properly maintain their roads. So different cities face very different situations. Some have the wherewithal to utilize a local transportation utility fee. Some can...
Just to follow up, do I misunderstand? Cities don't have the ability to add gas taxes now? Am I missing something there?
Cities absolutely can raise a gas tax now, and that would be the second thing I would ask, is that the legislature not preempt cities' ability to raise gas taxes. The city of Tigard just increased its gas tax. One of the problems is simply economics. For some cities, if they have one gas station and there's a neighboring community that has gas stations, folks will go buy their gas elsewhere. So it's not economical for them to charge that gas tax. If you're a small city on Highway 5 in a stretch of otherwise agricultural land, a gas tax may work well for you as a revenue raising mechanism. So it varies from community to community. Tigard's, the debate there I think was very vigorous about whether it made sense for them to establish a gas tax given the surrounding community that wouldn't have that same tax. From an economics point of view, a statewide gas tax, it makes the most sense. It also raises the most revenue for everyone, where some communities can't raise that revenue on their own.
Madam Chair, if I may,
yes.
Thank you. And Andy, that again, those communities who decide that they're going to go ahead and do that's an opportunity for them to do that. But please recognize that somewhere between 60% and 80% of Oregon is rural and does not have the kinds of transportation opportunities that you may have in some of the very well-developed cities and well-financed cities. Consequently, when you increase the gas tax for Representative Greg Smith's district, what's going to happen is that, first of all, they live very close to Washington, and between the self-serve and the fact that they can pull it directly off the barge over there is going to make a difference to those folks, as it does in Idaho, for my constituents. Second of all, my constituents, when we raise gas tax 10 or 15 cents, and that's probably at a minimum to start to address the issues that you've got here on this slide, when you begin to charge that 10 to 15 cents, my constituents don't have the ability to say, well, I guess I'll take the train to work today, or I guess, you know, to go get groceries in town, I'll wait for the bus. Those aren't alternatives. And we're 100% dependent upon the fact that we've got to pay that additional gas tax. So none of these solutions are easy solutions. My concern is that they might work in some communities, whereas they might not work in others. But it is it's easier for you to tell us, hey, why don't you raise your state gas tax, than it is for you to tell your members, 200 plus cities, hey, listen, maybe you'd better bite the bullet and make it a hard one. And the other side of it is that when the people fill in the name of the small town next to the town that has more gas stations, when they get sick and tired of riding on really, really bad roads, then at some point they're going to say, you know what, maybe I better start buying my gasoline down at Burt's station, because at least I know that 5 cents of that comes back into the city and is going to help me maintain the roads. I mean, if they feel like that they have no investment in their own roads and are willing, and knowing that their own gas tax is going to be contributing 5 cents, and that's the parity, that's the difference between the two communities, if they're willing to drive out of town for the 5 cents, maybe they'll be willing to move out of that town at some point when the roads get so bad that they don't like living there.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it was just last week, maybe Monday a week ago, that we heard from county commissioners. I think they're called judges in those more rural counties. And so I asked them in particular, because I live in Milwaukee, and one of the things that we've been looking at is raising a gas tax, which you also put in your book, or at least in this booklet. And they made it really clear that that would not be a viable alternative in their county, that they would consider raising a gas tax. They said that they would be recalled if that were the case. So in view of what Representative Butler has said and what I'm telling you about our meeting with the county commissioners, do you have any response to that?
And you both raised, I think, Chair Beyer and Representative Tomei, you both raised the challenge of asking the public to pay more for roads, which is essentially what we are asking. Our local communities have asked, many local communities have asked voters to pay through transportation utility fees on their homes, through gas taxes in a dozen cities and a couple counties. So they are stepping up to try to fill that gap. Small rural cities in particular that don't have the wherewithal to make a gas tax work, that it's not feasible to charge a transportation utility fee, those are really the ones I think that benefit the most by raising a statewide gas tax to generate funds that they otherwise wouldn't get and can't raise on their own, especially in light of the loss of timber revenues. The roads there are going to continue to deteriorate very quickly.
Madam Chair. Thank you. Follow up. So can you understand why my constituents in Milwaukee have some reservations about perhaps paying a statewide gas tax if they're hearing that the folks in rural Oregon aren't willing to tax themselves, but that they're asking us to tax us so that we can improve the roads as well as our roads?
Mm-hmm.
So
I understand that dilemma. At the same time, if we leave cities on their own and counties on their own to find their own resources, those that can will, and those that can't won't. So we'll further that gap between those counties that have, or the cities that have good roads and those cities whose roads are falling apart.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On your chart where you're looking at local funding options, prior to Measure 5, counties had an opportunity to assist their local communities with general fund dollars. And it's an interesting discussion, as Vice Chair Tomei was raising, and I think her point is very, very valid, very valid. The one issue in rural Oregon we always remember is that it wasn't rural Oregon that passed Measure 5. It was the larger counties, and up until that point, we felt like we had local control of our budgets, of our schools, of our, you know, of our general funded items. And You know, so this idea of funding, it's complex. And you're right, Vice Chair Tomei, trying to figure out where's that balance in who funds who, it's difficult.
If I could respond to that, Chair Beyer. Representative Smith, we've testified many times before the Finance Committee in both houses about the Measure 550 impacts, and certainly for smaller rural communities in particular that have very low permanent set rates, that dilemma is even more pronounced, where they don't have the permanent tax rate to fund even their operations. If they wanted to raise a levy for road maintenance, they would have to renew that every 4 years on an ongoing basis.
Well, let me share with this committee. In Morrow County, where there's a tremendous industrial base in the northern end of the county, without Measure 5, we'd be riding on golden streets. Our schools would be plaqued in gold. But because of Measure 5, we're not able to generate that revenue, and it is what it is.
Thank you. I just guess I had a couple of comments, and looking at your chart up here, there are a number of ways that the cities are trying to help themselves. I come from a city that has a local gas tax, and if you saw on the chart there, they're probably one of the higher in spending per mile of these cities that were on that chart. But Eugene also has a local gas tax, and they're struggling more than we are for some reason. I really can't tell you why, and are looking at another one. What we have is an industry that has going at any attempt to do local gas taxes. It's not that you're just battling, you know, the voters. You're battling the industry to get those. And that's just getting worse at this point. So there are a lot of cities who are trying to help themselves. And I think that while we all recognize there's a need in road funding, I'm not sure that all of us are willing to come together to find the solution in how we do that. And I think it's going to take all of us coming to the table and not just one group. And I think that's what we're working on. I think the business community is there. Cities and counties are there to help us. I think that there's other groups out there that should be coming to the table at this point, too. So I want to thank you for coming in.
If I could just close with one thought. Mm-hmm. Cities in the state and the counties have invested billions of dollars in our streets. They're really a vital asset economically, socially, and so on. And we should, as any business would, we should be investing in these roads to maintain them properly so that they don't fall apart and cause us much greater costs in the long run. Thank you so much for your time.
Very robust conversation.
It is. I would also like to add that I can, it depends on the week, day, where I can get gas cheaper. Even though I have a gas tax, my gas will be cheaper than a significant amount, and it depends. I mean, sometimes I like to fill up in Salem because it's cheaper, and sometimes I like to fill up in Eugene because it's cheaper. So I don't really think that really is a good judge of. So thank you. I'm going to go ahead and close the informational hearing, and thank you for waiting for us. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2466.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2466 is the measure that requires photo radar signs to be at least 36 inches by 18 inches in size and requires the posting of photo radar signs between 400 and 500 yards before the location of the unit. Now we have two amendments that you have before you at the dais. The Dash 4 amendments is the latest amendment from Representative Lim. That amendment restores current law such that the sign would be located between 100 and 400 yards before the photo radar unit. And it would require the sign to be posted at least 2 feet above the ground. We also have the Dash 5 amendments from Representative Hunt. These amendments add the cities of Gladstone, Milwaukee, and Oregon City as jurisdictions that may operate photo radar at their own expense. And we do have a no fiscal impact on those Dash 5 amendments. Both the original measure and the amendments have no revenue impact, still waiting for the fiscal on the dash fours. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. On this particular bill and this amendment that has come up pretty recently, I haven't heard from the additional cities that have been added to added to this bill. So I'm inclined to probably just close the work session and try to make contact with these cities to make sure that this is actually in their interest. So unless anyone is concerned, I'm...
May I
yes.
Just add some information that I got from the police chief who had been here, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and he just sent me some information about why we need photo radar in Milwaukee, and he just sent me a lot of information about posted speed limits, et cetera. But on McLaughlin, which is 99E, the speed limit is 45 miles an hour, and there are people going, eight were cited in 1 month, going 65 to 69, and one was going 70 to 75. And there are others, another one on Highway 224, which cuts through Milwaukee going out to I-205. Two were cited for going 90 to 94 miles an hour. So anyway, and our police department, as I'm sure it's true throughout the state, people are losing their police due to budget constraints. And so this, again, would be a tool that would be helpful in my city. But I would concur with you holding closing the work session.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do I understand then the Dash 4 committees, the Dash 4 amendments from Representative Lim, had an opportunity to review those at this particular point?
I did, and he is at one point I thought we were talking about changing the size of the sign. He seems to think the size of the sign is okay, so I don't know if we need to look for another amendment to actually change that or not, but it does put the sign where the police requested it.
And second question was Dash 5 amendment from Representative Hunt, had he been in contact with Gladstone, Milwaukee, and Oregon City, do you know? Or had those folks contacted him, perhaps?
Gladstone, if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
Gladstone, I'd already put in the amendment for Milwaukee, and he was contacted by Oregon City and Gladstone.
And just one more follow-up, Madam Chair. One of the items of testimony that I found that was somewhat disturbing was the fact that I think it was that only about 40% of the actual pictures were clear enough that they could utilize them, leaving 60% of the pictures that could even be considered for the first cut. I'm concerned about this wet film system technology, and if we didn't hear anything with regard to the actual technology people coming to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And these are very expensive systems. These are systems which I think one of the testimonies was given that we don't make almost anything off of it by the time we're done. By the time they pay the officers to be involved on a daily basis and then have to have them available for court and those kinds of things, that the maximum that they were making would gross something in excess of $40,000, but the direct expense with the machine was somewhere between $35,000 and $40,000 a month. So if we're going to hear testimony from these other communities, perhaps we can invite those folks who I think Sergeant Dan Costello from the Portland Speed Division had testified. Perhaps he would be in a position to invite the providers of some of these machineries so we can find out if they're going to be improving the technology, if they have any kind of plans that the photo radar will be enhanced in the future. Because if we do same old, same old, and they're walking past, I mean, it appears to me that we're doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. If it's costing us $40,000 a month and we're paying $40,000 a month, then really we'd ought to have speeds much, much slower in these areas with almost no tickets anymore. But the indication is there's still $2,500 tickets per month in these areas where the machines are at. So I would, if we're going to invite some of those other folks, then maybe that the folks with regard to the technology could be invited too. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good suggestion. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to let you know, as a courtesy, I'll be giving yes votes to the amendments. But I'm inclined to vote no on the bill. I'm really struggling with this. I'm not sure why motorists should be notified that photo radar is ahead when they're entering into an area where they ought to be driving the speed limit anyway. And then I this is just my personal belief, and I'm sure I'm in the minority, but I think it's silly that we require the police officers to be sitting in the hidden truck, and they can only do it for 4 hours. To me, it seems like this entire process is flawed. So it's just my thought. But I'll be giving you yes courtesy votes on the amendments.
Okay.
This is
Thank
from
you.
The guy who drives a Corvette.
I'm sharing. Hey, if I
he drives
if,
very well.
Will
you?
If I deserve a ticket, I deserve a ticket. And I know the speed limit as I drive, and I'm not sure if I'm violating the speed that I should be warned beforehand, slow down, because you're about to get a ticket. I mean, I should know that already. And so that's just my personal belief.
Yes. And it would also be kind of interesting to find out whether any, which I didn't even think about asking, whether any of these are really repeat offenders. Or have they learned about. Thank you for all the good suggestions, and we'll make sure we'll do another public hearing before we go to any kind of a work session on this bill, and thanks for your indulgence today. And I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2466. And I'm going to open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2902. And we have this lowly little crowd here. Judith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2902, I'm going to focus on the Dash 1 amendments because they do completely replace the original bill. The Dash 1 amendments create a Class A traffic violation for violating maximum weight limits if an enforcement officer determines that a vehicle was eligible for a variance permit. It provides that all other weight limit violations are punishable by penalties established in the referenced. I did provide a reference of the statutes. At your seat, you see both the situations where a variance applies followed by the penalties that are commensurate with various weight violations. For your easy reference, the Dash 1 amendments applies to violations that occur, of course, on or after the effective date. The Class A traffic violation is punishable with a fine of up to $720. We have received a no revenue impact, and we're still waiting on the fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Bob Russell and Tammy Denny, come up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and we drew straws to see who goes first, and so I'm going first. The Dash 1 amendments do completely replace the bill, and that's a very important piece. What this does is deals with one of those little esoteric pieces of trucking. If you operate a vehicle over 80,000 pounds, which we operate vehicles as much as 1 million pounds in this state, and then you have to get a permit. And there is one group of permit holders that are allowed to operate between 80,000 and 105,500 pounds. And those folks get a permit that's good for a year. People that are operating at those much heavier weights, they get a permit for that trip only. But between 80 and 105.5, the permit is good for a year. The purpose of the permit is basically safety and maintaining the condition of the road. We don't want the heavier vehicles to go places where they can't go or where they could possibly damage the road. So attached to the permit are maps and other instructions that tell them exactly what they can do and where they can go safely. The permits cost $8 for a state permit. Most counties and one city also issue permits, and they come attached. We can do them all in one big pile. Local permits cost between $2.75 and $8. You can get the permits from ODOT. You can get them from the local governments that issue them. You can get them from third-party agents. Actually, the Oregon Trucking Association issues a number of them. Today, if you don't get a permit for this one group between 80 and 105.5, and you stop at the scale, and you get a ticket for being overweight. So, for example, if you were at 105.5 and you would be perfectly legal, except you don't have the $8 permit, the penalty is 24 cents per pound over 80,000 pounds, or $6,120, which is a pretty stiff fine for failure to get a piece of paper. The penalty can also carry some jail time. So when someone receives a ticket like that, normally the judge will advise them to hire an attorney and then they deal with it. It doesn't happen very often. In most cases, 99.9% of the time, we've got the permit and we can show it to the enforcement people and everything is fine. But when it does happen, it is a shock. What this bill would do is it would create a new violation of failure to have a permit, and it's only for that one group between 80,000 and 105.5. It would make it a Class A traffic infraction, which is a normal Class A is $420 plus $70 in court costs, or $495 total. It can go to $720. And when that happens, it's because you're involved in an accident. There's a surcharge that goes on to the penalty if you're involved in an accident. In this particular case, most of these would not be involved in accidents at all. So it would be $495. We believe very strongly that $495 is a sufficient deterrent so that people won't just not get the permit. They will be encouraged to get the permit. But they won't get a $6,000 ticket in the event that they don't. We've worked with ODOT, and they're comfortable with it. And again, this only applies to trucks that are absolutely legal, except for that $8 permit. And that concludes my prepared testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question out of ignorance. Is there any difference between a truck having a permit at 80,000 pounds and at the upper range of that, except for the weight? In other words, does the permit cover that entire range, or is it more specific?
Madam Chair, Representative Reed, it covers that entire range. It's called a continuous operating permit. But what happens with a truck is you declare your weight, because a truck can, in this particular example, a truck can easily carry 105.5, but because of the nature of the operations, for example, if they were hauling ping pong balls, they wouldn't get near that heavy, so they would declare at 98,000, for example, and that's what they would be operating in. The weighmaster would also be checking their registration and their weight mile tax receipt, and that would show 98,000. The continuous permit would authorize the operations at that weight as well.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Russell. How would it happen that somebody would fail to have a permit?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, Ms. Denny is going to describe a situation, but one that happened to one of my members very recently is that they were operating at 80,000 pounds, which is known as the national legal limit. You can go any place in the country at 80,000 pounds, and this guy had been operating interstate all over the country. So he was operating at 80,000. He reduced his operations. For example, Washington, Idaho, and Oregon all allow operations up to 105.5. And so he went to ODOT and said, I want to increase my weight from 80,000 to whatever it was that he wanted. They increased it for registration. They charged him the additional registration fees. They gave him the new cab card to pay his weight mile tax, but they neglected to give him this continuous operating permit for $8. This happened at the Jansen Beach office up at the Washington border. He promptly drove down to Woodburn, and he got a several thousand dollar ticket and called me about 15 minutes later.
Representative Butner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, this reminds me of a piece of legislation that I was involved in a few years ago for a group of farmers in eastern Oregon where they had trucks that had a special weight that they could weigh in Idaho and particularly it was for specifically for field-loaded farm trucks. And running a chain on onions or potatoes for an extra 1 or 2 seconds could throw them well over the weight limit. And so what we were able to do was, in effect, we were able to go out, and I was surprised because we actually made money for the state as we did this. We encouraged then all the farm trucks that could carry that much more onions or sugar beets or potatoes that they would license for the higher weight in Oregon. The specific problem also was that as they were coming out of the field, if they would drive out of the field in on the Idaho side and the Oregon bench along what's called Big Bend, where the river changed channels courses back in the late 1800s or early 1900s, which is Oregon on one side of the field and Idaho on the other, they could actually drive out in Idaho and be legal the entire time. But as they would then drive the same road then back in to drop off the load in Nisa, Oregon, the jump scales were there, and then they were being fined. So actually what happened was they just bought this heavier permit, which actually created revenue immediately for the state of Oregon to buy the heavier permit. And it said, if you are a field-loaded farm truck, and you'll buy the heavier permit, which made money for the state instantaneously, then you could go ahead and operate within that range. And there's no way to know, particularly if the driver is driving behind the combine or driving behind the actual loading chain, and then drives out of the field when the guy lifts up the boom and says you're full and ready to head out, and has no idea that he may have an extra 1 or 2 seconds worth of onions or sugar beets on the load. That and again, as long as they were within that legal upper range, in this case the 105,500, as long as they were within that legal range, then there wasn't a fine. So and incidentally, one of my most favorite people in the whole world died this past month, and he was a farmer in Parma, Idaho, and had one of those fields that he could drive out on one side or drive out on the other. And one of his last comments to me before he passed away was, I'll never forget that you did that for the farmers in this community, because as I'd have to reroute, and he says, as much as we like the Parma packing sheds, we like the people better in Nisa, Oregon. And so once you did that, then that's when we went ahead and began doing the business with the packing sheds in Nisa again. And that was, to me, a great, great compliment. But it looks something that would look like it's going to cost us a lot of money we're going to start losing these $6,000 fines. The truth of the matter is that you start picking up people buying the heavier permits for what they're weighed for, and then finally, I'm glad that there is some uniformity amongst some of the western states. In my former life in the truck stop business, we would have truckers actually come in and find out that once they put 100 gallons or 200 gallons in the truck tanks and then filled the reefer tanks for the refrigeration, that they might have been 1,000 pounds overweight. And sometimes actually they had to, they actually had, as they were coming in, we were the first stop in Oregon, they'd actually then have to take part of their load and dump it off. And we had Tyson chicken for whatever price you'd like, or Gadsden, Alabama carpet for whatever price you'd like, because they just say, as they go over the scales on the way out of the truck stop, they look at it and say, you got a state scale down at Huntington, just a few miles from here, and I'm now 1,000 pounds. By the time I get down there, I'll be 950 pounds over. What do I do? And we'd get out the old checkbook and say, what do you got on your load? You might get 2 cents on the dollar for it.
Representative Buckley.
Location. Mr. Russell, I'm assuming that the penalty was set at this high level because this is taken very seriously about the impact of the trucks on the road. So, worst case scenario, do you know that if a Class A, if there's repeat offender, does the penalty increase? I'm from what you're saying, it's very infrequently done. But worst case scenario, if someone did do repeat offense on this,
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, the way this bill is written, it would just be the Class A penalty. ODOT has other tools in their toolkit. They have the habitual offender program that is designed just for the person that you're describing, and they actually will revoke the $8 permit, and tell them, no, you can no longer operate at those weights because you haven't followed the rules. So there are other tools that ODOT has, many other, actually, to make sure that that happens.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Denny, we'll give you your chance here.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tammy Denny. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Wheat Growers League. Our office is located in Eastern Oregon in Pendleton, and while it may seem odd that we're here to testify before you in this committee today, transportation is vitally important to our producers. If we can't move our commodity to market, there's no point in planting the seed at all, either in the wintertime or in the spring. So this matter of transportation and movement of the field-loaded trucks out onto highways, county roads, and possibly even onto interstates to then offload their grain to an elevator system. At times, it's unknown for that driver, as Representative Butler pointed out, whether or not they're going to be heavy or light on that particular load at 80,000 or above 80,000 until the time that they begin cutting a certain crop. Every year stands on its own. Every wheat farm stands on its own, and every kernel has to be harvested and determined what the weight of that crop is going to be, field by field by field. So at times, a driver could find themselves in an overweight situation. That's not the intent of growers, however, to operate in an overweight capacity. They are very much law-abiding citizens. They're very much adhering to the regulatory structure, and they understand that they are not exempt from weight, and they have to maintain those criteria, and they have to maintain their trucks in safe operating order. They understand that, and they adhere to that. And my producers are, in fact, take all of those responsibilities very seriously. They're employing those who are young at age, maybe 18 years old, and putting them behind the wheel of those vehicles. They're taking their safety very seriously. Many of them are relatives of their own children, as a matter of fact, drive those vehicles from the field to the elevator. So they take it very seriously. We're not advocating for unsafe roads, unsafe practices, or unsafe weight limits. We're simply wanting to speak on behalf of House Bill 2902 and the -1 amendments in favor of, because we believe that this is a common sense approach to allowing for those times when the crop may come in a little bit heavier than what we had anticipated, and a grower sends their driver to the elevator, they weigh in a little bit heavy, and they end up being cited. A $6,000 fine seems to be a bit onerous, and we can mitigate that by creating an opportunity to say you are going to experience some economic injury, but that economic injury is going to remind you that you do need to purchase that $8 certificate, that permit, so that you are legal and legitimate. I can convey for you an instance where my association president, who now lives in Klamath Falls, his name is Mike Noonan. He was unable to be with us today because he's recovering from a heart attack. He operates a fleet of trucks out of Klamath Falls and moves commodity, or he also produces organic crops, moves a great deal of those organic crops up to the Willamette Valley and moves crop into California. He deals with a number of issues and the differences in law between the states of Oregon and California. He was fined several thousand dollars for failure to have a certificate, this $8 permit, and it was simply because it was a brand new truck. And it was one of those times when, oh, whoops, we'd forgotten that that was another piece of the puzzle. You have to put all the puzzle pieces together in a correct order in order to not find yourself in that kind of economic injury. So we want to be certain that our growers continue to adhere to the law, of course, and that they operate in a safe manner, of course. But we also think that there's an opportunity to create some better regulatory regime that is, provides a reminder, but it doesn't take our growers out at the knees either. So thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you today, and I'd be glad to answer any questions. And fortunately, Bob is still here so he can answer the more particular information regarding the bill.
Thank you. Representative Gilman.
Bob, the original bill has a provision in here for an increase in overwidth or overlength. What happened to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, you're correct. There were two pieces to this bill originally, and this has been a real odyssey getting this thing drafted. And there was another set of circumstances where somebody fails to adhere to the provisions of a permit. And the example that we used was if you are moving a mobile home, which is very wide, and you are required to have pilot cars, today the fine for that is a Class B infraction, which I think is about $180. And what was happening up here was that some of the mobile home toters were not hiring the pilot cars because the penalty was less than the cost of the pilot cars. So we originally had that second piece in this particular bill. Well, when we drafted the bill, and then we went back and said, well, that's not what we wanted, this particular provision fits under this relating clause. So this bill goes as it is. That piece, the way it needs to be drafted, does not fit under this relating clause. I talked to legislative counsel just before the hearing, and I said, how are we coming on the language? Because this particular chapter is the most confusing that I have ever read in my life. It took three of us, I don't know how many hours, to draft this bill and make sure that we were getting exactly what we wanted. So we're still working on that, and unfortunately, she said, I need another note. So I have a meeting with the chair tomorrow, and I will be asking for another note so that we can get that piece drafted and moving as well. But it didn't fit in this relating clause.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support the bill, support the amendments. I appreciate you folks bringing this forward. I'm going to offer a thought, though, that I know I'm in the minority on, especially with the Wheat League, but I'm going to offer this thought. If I could amend this bill, the one thing I would add is that the citation be issued to the owner of the vehicle, not the driver. And let me share with you my thought on that. Quite often, especially during harvest, as Tammy, you're saying, you know, you might have a college kid who's driving the rig.
Absolutely.
And quite often the college kid is doing what he's told.
Absolutely.
And I've also professionally have financed trucking companies who own multiple short hauling trucks, and there's a real pressure sometimes on these drivers because they're paid by the load to move. And sometimes if the driver was to speak up, they may be concerned about their employment. And that's just a reality out where I am, especially when it's harvest time and it's short haul movement time. You got to move. When it's time to harvest, you harvest. And so, I'm not advocating an amendment. If I had my way, I would place that on the owner of the vehicle. So that way, whoever owns this thing is going to make sure that it's operated appropriately.
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that provision is already in this bill.
I stand corrected.
Nice speech, though.
Thank you.
You got me.
We agree with you, and if you'll look at the amendment in Section 1, it says a person commits the offense of violating maximum weight limits if the person does any of the following. Drives or moves on a highway any vehicle or combination that exceeds the weight limits, da-da-da-da. And Section B, owns a vehicle or combination of vehicle and causes or permits the vehicle or combination of vehicles to be driven or moved. That's the piece that gets at the owner of the vehicle. The court has the option of holding either one or both responsible.
Perfect. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Representative Tomei.
You get it.
Madam Chair, if you will indulge me, this is completely off the topic, if I may. Ms. Denny, you heard the discussion earlier about the terrible condition that our roads are in, and especially in the rural areas, and that must affect the folks that you're representing. Do your folks have any sense on what would be helpful to improve those roads?
Vice Chair Tomei, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the issues concerning public safety, road conditions are ever present out in the minds of those who drive those rural roads. If it's any consolation, and it may not be, I spend quite a bit of time in Washington, D.C., taking care of issues on behalf of our industry in the nation's capital as well. The roads in Washington, D.C. are such that a small car could get lost in a pothole. And every time, and it seems to be commonplace that that's understood, that that's just the way it is on the East Coast. In all of my travels, they bring me back to Oregon. And every time I return home, I am appreciative and reminded of how fortunate we are in our state that we take such good care of the property and the resources that are in our keeping. So I know that that's not the answer necessarily that you as a committee are looking for, and I understand that the solutions are not easy when it comes to those issues about taxation and how do we tax ourselves as a public to keep up the services that we all demand and we all expect. And we expect that food is going to continue to be afforded to us, that public safety is going to continue to be afforded to us, and we're going to continue to drive on wonderful streets. And we don't have to pay for it. Someone else will. Someone else will grow our food. Someone else will take care of us. That's not the case. That's not reality. That's not grown-up land. But we'd like to believe that it is. So if it's any assurance to you as members that are working so hard here in the state capitol, you're doing a terrific job. And our roads, while they're not perfect, certainly are a testament to that fact. So thank you for all of your hard work.
And thank you. Thank you. I hope you take back the message to your industry that this is an issue that we're very concerned about. I'm glad to hear you say that our roads are in better shape than the East Coast, but you're also hearing that they're in danger of getting much, much worse, and we need to start taking care of them. So anyway, I hope that there is a conversation with your industry about how they could see this happening to benefit your industry as well as the rest of the state.
If I might, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Tomei, and members of the committee, the issues surrounding transportation are vitally important, as I mentioned earlier, to our industry. Representative Butler has been a champion in providing access to some additional roads and high and county roads and moving commodity. That exemption that he spoke of is not available statewide to growers who are field loading trucks. Agriculture is an industry within this state that drives this economy, and so we are very much dependent upon the roads, we're very much dependent on the river, and we're very much dependent on the railroad. We have to have a healthy multimodal system in order to move the goods that we produce. And it all has to work interdependently. Not one mode can stand above another, and we certainly don't want trucks lined up from Pendleton or from Morrow County coming into the Port of Portland at harvest time. We don't want that. It's not a safe and efficient way for us to move goods, and you don't want that as consumers here clogging up the freeways and the interstates all the way into town from the rural communities. So we have to have this multimodal system that is interdependent, that is efficient, that is affordable. We all have to pay for that, and we understand that that's the case. And my industry understands that they're paying their fair share through paying for $3 a gallon diesel, and as of last summer, we were selling wheat into a $3 market. Fortunately, today, wheat's selling for $5.75 a bushel. A bushel is 60 pounds of commodity, so 60 pounds of goods being sold for $5. While in the ag community, that sounds really good, to you as an individual, I'm sure you're thinking, $5 for 60 pounds? That doesn't seem very equitable. But $3 for 60 pounds is less equitable, and $3 for a gallon of diesel fuel to run your equipment really hurts, economically speaking. So adding a fuel tax on top of that, we really create a situation quite quickly out in the ag community where growers are, they're living on very tight margins anyway, and it's pretty tough for them to afford additional expenses without being able to recoup any kind of additional on their investment. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Committee, before I close the public hearing, ODOT is in the room. Does anyone have any questions?
Madam Chair, Ms. Denny was absolutely right that that particular farm-loaded truck, field-loaded on the farm truck bill applied to Malheur County, where we had that circumstance, because it couldn't apply to Umatilla County, it couldn't apply to most other places because of the nature of the highways. The federal highway system would not allow that to happen, and so as long as we stayed in those delivery areas, that was the case. And further, I would say that the farm and ranch community were the first to step up and say we're willing to pay that higher fee because the truck is capable of handling that additional weight, and if it's capable of handling that additional weight, and again, it's not through any fault of their own. We actually had some folks come and testify as the density of a piece of grain versus a potato, the actual the potato the same size one year or out of one field versus another, the identical potato in size can be 30% different in overall weight. So when we get to some of these very technical areas, I think that it's really important that we address it. Now, in that process, too, because Ms. Denny is coming from largely an agricultural area, and meeting with the counties this morning, I think that there is a potential we'll have to change a law that was cut off 100 years ago, or not quite 100 years ago, probably 60 years ago, that dealt with rural road assessment districts. And that is, if you live in a farming community and you can identify what that farming area is, where you're growing the grain, harvesting the grain, getting it to the elevator and back and forth, you can, right now you can't, but we used to could. And we did, and only Malheur County has those rural road assessments. But it fit a very limited exemption at the time, seemed to make sense at the time, and then it went away. But now we're talking about, and it is an assessment. It's not a new tax. It's an assessment, and they can assess themselves for their own roads. And the testimony that we had from the rural road districts in Malheur County is that don't ever take that away from us, because we want to pay that. And you say, you want to pay an extra 53 cents per thousand on the place where you live, or 23 cents, or whatever it was. Yes, we do. We want to pay that, and that's on the real market value, not on the assessed value. It's on the real market value, and the reason that they want to pay that is the cost of replacing the fan belts and the radiators and those kinds of things in those trucks, it ain't cheap. And they're saying this is the cheapest way for us to run our equipment, is to run them on good roads, and we're willing to pay for them. And I think that those are the kinds of tools. That isn't something we can necessarily do in the city, but I want to make sure that those kinds of tools are available so that counties can say, vote yourself a rural road district. You have 100,000 acres of grain being produced from here to here to here to here. Call that a rural road assessment district. Go out and say, look, there's 200 homes in that rural road assessment district amongst that 100,000 acres. Ask those people if they're willing to go ahead and pay X number of cents per thousand on the real market value to maintain their roads. And if they say, nah, let our roads go to hell, we don't care, then they've had the opportunity to vote. But more likely than not, and again, this comes from the personal experience I've had with my farmers, they say, don't take that away from us because we want to pay it because it saves us money every harvest season. We're faster, quicker, better, and our equipment runs cheaper.
Thank you. And I assume no one had any questions for ODOT?
Well, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So who gets to answer the questions?
This is process.
Target on his back.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Jack,
I'm just wondering if, thank you, Jack. I'm just wondering if ODOT has a position on this bill.
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, we have absolutely no problems with this bill at all. It's a good measure. Our motor carrier folks have been working with Bob on some of the technical details. It provides consistency within the statute, and it just makes a lot of sense.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. No other questions? Thank you, Jack. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2902, and I'm going to go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2902.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2902 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Amendment.
Oh, sorry. I move -1 amendment to House Bill 2902. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tomei moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 2902, dated 3/15/07. Any discussion?
I have no discussion. Madam Chair, will this be the vehicle, or will there be another vehicle that will be used, a bill, that will accommodate the overwhelmed load Mr. Russell was referring to previously.
Thank you for the question. I assume since it didn't fit in here, we had to find another vehicle. But
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell of the Oregon Trucking Association. Madam Chair is absolutely correct. There was lack of understanding of what we were trying to do in the first place. The relating clause was written too narrowly to accommodate the second piece. So we will be looking for another vehicle as well as a note when we visit with Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair, the only reason I ask that is it was included in the first bill with the first relating clause, and so that's the only reason I ask it. I thank you very much for accommodating that question.
I had the question too. Thank you. All right. Those of the opinion that the -1 amendments dated 3/15/07 should be adopted will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will call. Oh, is there anyone opposed? The -1 amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2902 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2902 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, those of the opinion House Bill 2902 should be reported to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended. We'll vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Yes.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. The motion carries.
Do you think we could put this on the consent calendar?
Madam Chair, as much as this has been amended, I would like to carry this to the floor.
Thank you. We have a volunteer. Any opposition? Seeing none.
Thank you.
Representative Butler will carry the bill. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2902. And committee, we won't be meeting on Friday. Hopefully we won't have to meet on Fridays, but we're getting close, and we might end up having to do that sometime in the next couple of weeks. But as long as I can get away with it, you have the afternoon off.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned.
That was an entire